This is an ABC podcast.
Hi, it's All in the Mind on RN. I'm Lynne Malcolm. And today, we're getting a little weird.
Yeah, so we first coined the acronym WEIRD, which stands for Western Educated Industrialized Rich and Democratic, when two colleagues of mine, Ara Norenzion and Steve Heine at the University of British Columbia, we compiled all the available evidence on psychological differences across societies that we could find. This was between about 2006 and 2010. And we found that not only were the most commonly used subjects by psychologists, which were university students, often in the US or Europe, also places like Australia and the US, not only were they one population among many, showing a lot of cultural variation in psychology, but they were often anchoring the extreme ends of the distribution. So they were unusual from a global perspective. So we started referring to these subjects as WEIRD, using the acronym, as a way of kind of raising people's consciousness about how unusual the most commonly used subjects in psychology were. And we're talking about 96% of all participants in psychology experiments are from WEIRD societies.
Professor Joe Henrich, anthropologist and chair of the Department of Human Evolutionary Biology at Harvard University. He and his colleagues first coined the term WEIRD in their 2010 paper in the journal Behavioural and Brain Sciences. It's called The Weirdest People in the World. They sounded the alarm about the dangers of conducting the majority of psychological research using subjects from a tiny minority of the world's population. Since then, the field of cultural psychology has slowly grown.
For people in a majority cultural group, they do not necessarily aware of those differences. They may continue to claim that everyone is the same. So sort of colorblind approach in psychological research. One way to think about culture is when a fish lives in a pond, the fish doesn't really realize the existence of the water, right? The fish may only exist in water when the fish is taken out of the pond or changed to another pond. Then suddenly realized I was in this initial dark water, right? So the culture is like the water. So we may easily take it for granted without being aware that it's influencing our behavior.
Professor Qi Wang, Department Chair of Human Development at Cornell University. And we'll hear more about how she incorporates considerations of culture into her research. Joe Henrich's recent book is called The Weirdest People in the World: How the West Became Psychologically Peculiar and Particularly Prosperous. So where did these so-called weird or Western-educated, industrialized, rich and democratic societies originate?
Well, in the book, I try to develop a theory about psychological variation and, in addition, why it was that it arose primarily in Western Europe. So the key idea, the kind of pebble that leads to the avalanche of the rise of European societies, is a particular set of marriage prohibitions and prescriptions that develop in the Western Church. So this is the branch of Christianity that eventually becomes the Roman Catholic Church. And the church began in late antiquity, so around the year 400 or 500, to prohibit cousin marriage, prevent people from marrying their in-laws. And gradually, these taboos got more intense over centuries until eventually the church prevented people from even marrying six cousins, was messing with the inheritance systems of different groups, and doing a number of other things to marriage and the family.
So what specifically makes weird groups different from others? Can you perhaps summarize what the key traits of the weird group are?
Yeah, so psychologically, high levels of individualism. So people focus on themselves. They tend to be overconfident and self-enhancing. They tend to focus on their own attributes and aspirations and those of others. So they're aspiring to make themselves unique in competition with others. And they also tend to be quite trusting of strangers, cooperative with strangers. They focus on people's dispositions and intentions, so they're very concerned with internal mental states. They focus on these over relationships. They tend to be guilt-ridden, but not have very much shame. and they are inclined towards analytic thinking over holistic thinking. So they tend to focus on objects and assign properties and categorize to explain these things. So think about assigning charges to particles or personalities to people to explain them, instead of focusing on their relationships and their interconnections within the social network, a holistic thinking.
So there's a sense that the weird group are more individualistic and the other groups are more collective thinking.
Yeah, so remember that there's many dimensions of variation and the variation is continuous. So one of the things that I spend some time on in the book is looking at the variation just among European societies. So I can look at the history of Europe and compare different regions within Europe and show the same kind of variation. I particularly focus in on Italy, because northern and southern Italy had very different histories with regard to their exposure to the Roman Catholic Church. And you can explain a lot of the variation in Italian psychology by using historical data to look at that variation.
So why is it so important to distinguish these weird societies in psychological research?
Well, I think the big idea in the book and in my own research is taking seriously the idea that, you know, as a species, we've evolved to have very malleable brains. So we're a kind of cultural species. And so we come into the world ready to mold our ways of thinking and our minds and our preferences and our emotions to adapt to the social worlds we encounter. This could be affected by technology and language, but I think institutions are particularly important. That's why in the book I focus on the institutions related to the family, because those are the first and most important institutions that people encounter. Now, in the book, I also point out how other institutions matter, things like markets. But just thinking about this idea that institutions and psychology can co-evolve gives us a kind of new understanding of the spectrum of human variation, the idea that people in different places think about the world differently and actually perceive the world differently. So you can do perception experiments and detect some of this variation as well.
Yes, one of the examples you give is the Müller-Lyer optical illusion. Can you outline that illusion and what was found in research to demonstrate why and how weird people saw it differently to others?
Yeah, so this is a famous illusion, and many listeners will be familiar with it. So one line has arrows facing in, and another line has the tails of arrows, so the way you would draw an arrow. And when people from places like Australia and the U.S. look at this illusion, you can measure the strength of the illusion by figuring out how much you have to increase the line segment with the inward-facing arrows, the kind of arrowheads. How much you have to lengthen that before it appears the same length as the other line. So it's an illusion where one line segment looks shorter than the other line segment, and the strength is captured by how much you have to lengthen the other one before people perceive them as equal in length. And then when anthropologists in the 1960s began to conduct this experiment in populations around the world, they found that hunter-gatherer populations, for example, don't see the illusion. So they accurately perceive the lines as being of equal length. And the standard explanation for this is called the carpentered corners hypothesis. So we grow up in a world of carpentered corners where walls and tables and all have lots of 90-degree angles. But the natural world that humans evolved in doesn't tend to have 90-degree angles. So our visual system seems to calibrate to the world we encounter or the world we commonly encounter. And so you get this variation in the perception to visual illusions.
So this is an example of how weird traits can skew the results of experimental psychology for a broader population?
Yeah, that's one example of how you can get differences in perception. There's also differences in the ability to take into account a background context. So if you compare East Asians, for example, and Americans, which is a common experimental comparison, Americans are better at telling the absolute lengths and sizes of things, whereas East Asians, even if they're living in America, are better at telling the relative sizes of different things. So you can pick it up in that way, this difference.
I wonder if you could point out perhaps another example or two of how people in the weird group are shown to be outliers in experimental studies.
So one interesting one is the use of intentions and moral judgments. So probably most listeners will have the intuition that a person's intentions is very important in judging their guilt or innocence in, say, in a crime or in violating a norm or something, if they do it by accident or if they do it on purpose. So we even have all kinds of legal definitions around that. But it turns out that Westerners are at the extreme end of the distribution on how much weight they place on intentions. So a team of anthropologists led by Clark Barrett from UCLA conducted experiments around the world in societies that vary in the intensity of their kinship systems. So the degree that people are woven deeply into social networks. So it's related to the importance of the family. And their work shows that at the extreme end, where families are monogamous nuclear families, people care a lot about intentions, and they're judging others based heavily on those intentions, sometimes solely on the intentions. And then at the other end of the distribution, there's populations, for example, in Fiji in the Pacific, where in lots of experiments, they don't show any attention to the intentions, just to the outcomes. But I think that all of this psychological variation that we're finding around the world has been missed until recently because of the tendency of psychology to focus on their easily accessible subjects and then quickly generalizing to people. So psychology textbooks are filled with really what's cultural psychology. It's how people from particular society think.
And as you say, so often those participating in social psychology experiments are Western university students. And this is very limiting, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it really skews our views of the breadth of human psychological variation. And this could have important implications for things like innovation and how institutions are built, why institutions that evolved in one country and are transported to another country may or may not work. And it goes well beyond social psychology. So it's certainly true of developmental psychology, behavioral economics, and a number of other disciplines that rely on experimental participants.
Mm. So to what extent are weird populations representative of the psychological makeup of the human species in general?
Well, I mean, I think along lots of domains, so I've listed out several of them, they're not representative. In fact, they're at the extreme end of the distribution. So really our current science is skewed towards this one population, and we don't have a good sense of the breadth. I try to bring together the evidence we do have, but we're really at the tip of the iceberg here, and we don't know how deep the iceberg goes or how big it is in terms of the breadth of psychological variation that's around the world once we really get started in sampling diverse populations that speak very different languages from European languages and lead different lives.
Joe Henrich from the Department of Human Evolutionary Biology at Harvard University and author of The Weirdest People in the World. You're with All in the Mind on RN. I'm Lynn Malcolm, and we're discussing how psychological research is skewed towards the so-called weird group. People from Western, educated, industrialised, rich and democratic societies are used as subjects in the vast majority of experimental studies. But this group is not adequately representative of the psychology of the human species in general. Since Joe Henrich pointed out this phenomenon, many researchers are trying to counter this bias by taking into account the important influence of culture on our behaviour and our psychology. Professor Qi Wang is Department Chair of Human Development at Cornell University. She first studied psychology in Beijing at Peking University. She's speaking with producer Jane Lee.
I wear multiple hats. I study children and, you know, their development. So in that case, I'm a developmental psychologist. And I'm particularly interested in cognitive development, particularly memory development. In that case, put me in the cognitive psychology area. On the other hand, I'm also interested in how culture or cultural factors influence development and influence memory development in particular. So in that case, I call myself cultural psychologist as well. So cultural psychology, in my view, is to understand the fundamental role of culture that plays in shaping our thinking, our behavior, and other psychological processes.
Qi Wang explained to Jane Lee her research interest in how culture shapes memory, particularly in children.
One of the important elements of culture is social practices or child-rearing practices. So one of the things we looked at is how parents interact with children in a way that can influence children's development. And in relation to memory development, we looked at how parents share memories with children as a way to mold children into the way that, you know, memory is typically preserved in that particular culture.
So what specific cultures can you point to that colour certain types of memories? So, for example, in European cultures or in Asian cultures, do you see trends across different types of coloured memories?
Yes. As we know, like in European American culture, there's a great emphasis on the individual's subjective experiences, you know, how we feel, how we see things, how we think about what's happening and so forth. So emphasize subjective experiences or autonomy of the individual. Also the role the individual plays in their own life, right? What you did and so forth. So when sharing memories with children, European American parents often focus on children's subjective experiences in the past events, right? Asking children how they felt in the past event, what they thought about things, and also focus on the children's own actions and roles in the past event, right? You know, when we talk about birthday party, what present you got? So focus on the child's roles and perspectives in the past event.
Right, the child is at the center of the memory. It's sort of they're the hero of the story kind of thing.
Yes, exactly. We can also call it the child is a leading actor or leading player in the story about the child. We know in Asian cultural context, oftentimes there's a great emphasis about don't accentuate yourself. You know, you should pay attention to other people, right? Especially in people important in your life. And so that sentiment is also reflected in how parents share memories with their children, where we found that East Asian parents oftentimes focus on other people's roles in the past events. So instead of just asking the child how you felt about your birthday, they would ask who came, who gave you the present, and who did this and that, right? So gave a lot of attention to other people as a way to emphasize the relationship between the child and important others in the child's life. And interestingly, when we interview children, to ask children to recount their own experiences, right? You know, tell me what happened last time when you had your last birthday. We observe exactly the same cultural differences that we observed in how parents, you know, share memories with their children. Even at the young age, at 3 and 4 and 5, as soon as they are able to articulate their experiences, they already show those cultural differences in terms of to what extent they focus on their own roles and perspectives versus whether they would share spotlight with other people when they remember their experiences.
Qi Wang gives another example of how the consideration of culture can make a difference to the outcomes of research. This time it's regarding the way people from different cultures perceive things.
It has been consistently shown that Westerners tend to show analytic perceptual style. So when they view things, they tend to break things into parts and to perceive those parts as an independent unit. Whereas East Asians often show a holistic perceptual style, where they tend to see things as a whole. Everything's related, right? So instead of just sort of see something, you know, a fish swimming in the pond, they see how the fish and the seaweeds are connected. So they look at how the background and foreground things are connected and how the water and the fish are related and so forth. So they see things as interrelated as a whole, right? So the leading researcher in this area, his name is Richard Lisbett. So they have done tons of work to consistently show this phenomenon. What we've more recently found, a recent study that's just accepted by the journal Cognition, my collaborator Kenna Swallow and I, we looked at how this can be applied in everyday activities. So, for example, you show people making coffee. The whole idea about making coffee can be broken down into small parts. You know, you grind the coffee bean and then you boil the water and then you use a filter to you put in the coffee maker. And then eventually after you're done, you pour the coffee and put some cream and you drink, right? So those are very distinct elements of this entire thing as making coffee. So we show Indians and Americans those everyday activities, making coffees, doing dishes, making beds and so forth. So everyday activities. And then we ask them to parse this activity into distinct events. What we found is consistent with what I just talked about, the holistic and analytical thinking or perceptual style. We found that U.S. participants tend to separate this continuous kind of activity into more distinct number of small events than did Indians, who are more likely to see things as interconnected. As a result, they tend to pass this activity into, you know, smaller number of events.
am really interested in that, you know, you're talking about different cultural groups as a whole, but I'm wondering, do these studies distinguish between, say, Indian subjects in India and second generation Indian migrants in, say, Australia?
Oh, in our study, the Indian participants from India. Yeah, you are absolutely right. When you look closer, depending on your research question, some researchers look at how generations of immigrants, you know, in Australia or in America, how they behave or think. You can find very distinct differences, even among the same ethnic group. Again, that shows the influence of cultural experiences. It's not genetic. If it's just genetic, then you shouldn't be able to see generational differences or cohort differences among the same immigrant group. But in fact, you see drastic differences, you know, between first generation and third generation or second generation. Again, shows the influence of cultural experience.
Chi Wang from Cornell University. So just going back a bit to the weird concept, the W in weird stands for Western, but our geographic identity is very malleable. How are cultural psychological traits passed on and sustained generation to generation? And does your research, say, account for immigration?
Yeah, so we actually use immigrants a lot to look at how this process goes. So one concern would be that some of the patterns we might be seeing when we compare countries or different populations are just individuals responding, say, to the costs and benefits of the institutions in the world they live in, that it's not a deeply cultural thing. So this would be a typical explanation that you might get from an economist, the people responding to the immediate costs and benefits. But if you look at second-generation immigrants to places like Europe or the U.S., you can compare people living in the same towns or cities and who grew up there. So look at second-generation immigrants, but see if you can predict their behavior by using facts about where their parents came from. And this shows that you can still detect the cultural echoes of where the parents came from, even when you're dealing with people who were raised in the same city or country. But of course, you know, you see it much attenuated than you would see in the prior generation. You know, there's an acculturation process, and they'll be indistinguishable from the larger population by the second or third generation immigrants. You know, depending on the details and the presence of ethnic enclaves can complicate things. But in general, you know, people very quickly learn, then, you know, within a few generations, learn the local culture of wherever they move to.
And you also write in your book that it's not a good idea to set up a weird versus a non-weird dichotomy. Why is that?
That's one of my things I worry about with the term, is because it kind of invites that dichotomous distinction. But when we look at global variation, we see that variation is continuous. So although I mentioned that European countries and European descent countries like Australia often anchor the ends of the distribution, there's still a distribution. So there's lots of countries that you wouldn't want to classify as weird that can be more towards the weird end of the distribution. And even when we look within Europe or within European descent countries, we still see lots of interesting variation. So I was mentioning the case of Italy earlier, where you can just analyze just Italy and you can apply these ideas and explain some of the variation.
Joe Henrich first sounded the alarm about the dangers of relying on research using only experimental subjects from so-called weird societies around a decade ago. How does he feel now about the extent to which this skewing of psychological research has been acknowledged?
Well, I feel like things have gone well in terms of getting the word out and raising people's consciousness on this. And when I talk to psychologists and economists, you know, they recognize the problem and they know it needs to be solved. But I think something about the structure of academic disciplines has really prevented that from taking off. So in psychology, researchers became very concerned with the replication crisis. So the fact that their basic experiments weren't replicating. And that kind of took a lot of attention away from this comparative cross-cultural enterprise of documenting psychological variation. And it's hard, like if you're trying to get a psychological PhD, to dedicate the time necessary to set up diverse field sites in different places and be able to collect the kind of data you need. So there's lots of sort of structural institutional incentives that I think prevent scientists from doing the kind of work that many would agree that needs to be done.
And so in a way, researchers continue to be rewarded for using mainly weird subjects and not diversifying pools. What, if anything, do you think it will take to change this?
Well, I guess I'm still hopeful, although I've been trying to be hopeful for many years now, that one key would be that granting agencies and academic journals start to push back and force people to, if they've done some experiments with, say, you know, American online subjects, there's like standard pools that researchers use, they need to explain why they think that they can generalize their findings beyond the subject pool. So, I mean, just recently there was a paper on moral psychology published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that was entirely based on American subjects but made grand generalizations to the species. And it just made me feel like we're making very little progress getting people to take this problem seriously.
To what extent do you think racism plays a big part in this?
You know, I haven't detected much racism. I think it's more like cultural centric. In some sense, it's related to individualism, in the sense that people are focused on their own populations and the challenges that people in their culture face. They're not conscious enough as the degree to which people in other places live very different lives and think about the worlds differently. So I think it comes from a place of not knowing the world. So many, many researchers in this field are not well trained in history. They don't speak other languages. They haven't spent long periods of time living outside of their home countries.
Professor Joe Henrich from the Department of Human Evolutionary Biology at Harvard University and author of The Weirdest People in the World. Qi Wang told Jane Lee how she thinks Joe Henrich's work on weird psychology is influencing the field.
For general psychologists who don't look culture for one reason or another, then that paper really brings up the awareness that it is simply wrong to claim about human behavior, human nature, based on a population that's a very small percentage in the world population. And the outcome of that population oftentimes different from the rest of the world. So I think that paper is, you know, important in raising the awareness among the general psychologists.
And finally, there have been many strategies proposed over the years to increase the proportion of cross-cultural research in psychology. They largely involve university departments and funding agencies diversifying the subjects that they study. But that requires them to see the value in cross-cultural research in the first place. So what do you personally think is the best way forward?
Well, as researchers, if our ultimate goal is to understand human behavior, then that's something we must do. Our goal is not to just understand human behavior, you know, of the weird population. If that's the goal, then go for it, right? Otherwise, you know, as researchers, you know, we have to ask ourselves, what is our goal? Is it to save time and to get a couple papers out quickly? Or is it to truly understand, you know, the phenomenon and also whether, you know, culture plays a role in that? So we have to ask ourselves that hard question, unfortunately. But it's not that difficult once you get hold of it, like the fish, once you pay attention to the water you live in, right? You know, what it tastes like and so forth. So when we raise that kind of awareness among our researchers, I think things can happen in a positive direction.
Professor Qi Wang from Cornell University, speaking there with Jane Lee. And thanks today to producers Jane Lee and Diane Dean. I'm Lynn Malcolm. Catch you next time. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.